Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with Ian Pearson. Mr. Pearson is the futurist for British Telecom and consults widely on a variety of futurist topics, lives in England. Welcome, Mr. Pearson.
Hello.
Now, I want to start off the conversation with your reflections on the state of futurology in general. I got my first subscription to The Futurist back in 1974. My dad wanted me to take a close look at this phenomenon, and I've always tried to be a amateur futurist myself. But it seems like the field has waxed and now waned, that it's more difficult today to get people excited about the idea of a systematic investigation of future scenarios than it was in the past. Do you think that that's true?
I don't really know. I mean, I've been doing this for about 11 or 12 years, so I can't go any further back than that. But, I mean, certainly there seems to be an enormous amount of interest in the future now. I mean, certainly when I was a child, there was a lot of interest. There's still a lot of interest now. Whether it's gone up or gone down slightly over a long period, I can't really say. I certainly haven't noticed much of a change during the time I've been doing it.
Well, one of the reasons that I think people's attitudes may have changed a little bit, at least in the perhaps in the science fiction community, you know, that I'm more familiar with, and that is that the future appears like it may be much more discontinuous than it was in the past. You know, that certain kinds of linear trends, extrapolations, when we look back on the history of them, they don't seem to have borne out because of the discontinuities of things like microprocessing.
That's certainly true. The rate of change is increasing all the time. In fact, we're seeing the rate of acceleration of the rate of change increasing all of the time. So every differential is increasing. But a lot of very poor quality predictions have been made in the past. But if you look at who's actually made those, usually there haven't been professional futurists. There's been ordinary people doing ordinary jobs who have made wild speculations about where things might go. They haven't always thought them through. And you know, a lot of those headlines have hit the news, and because the people are in prominent positions, and the futurist community has taken the blame for that, which is kind of unfair because the professional futurists are a lot more careful usually about what they say.
So what kinds of methods or systematic approaches to this investigation would you say characterizes professional futurology or futurism from the amateur?
Well, there are a lot of different techniques. I mean, some of the things you can do in the future rely just on simple extrapolation about where things are going at the moment. For example, when I talk to a lot of people like myself in research labs around the world doing research, and you work out what they're doing research on today, and you ask them how long it's likely to take them to get some results from it, and if you know that, then it's fairly safe to extrapolate a few years hence and figure out, you know, what sort of things we're likely to have as a result of that research. Other things that you can do scenario planning and so on, where you can pull together an awful lot of, you know, seemingly unconnected things from lots of different places, like, you know, from historians who are sort of giving you some view as to where things have gone in the past given certain conditions. They can make deductions of where things might go next. You can put that together with what you know, various people are investing in or what people are developing in the research labs. You can put together a wide range of very different things and link those together and see how they all interact. And then you can draw various conclusions as to, you know, what scenarios are quite likely for the future. Maybe you get down to just three or four quite likely scenarios. Even futurists can't say what's going to happen in the future. All we can ever say is, you know, what sorts of things lie on the in that big long plane in the future that you know, we're hoping to cross, and there are some interesting places out there, and you can avoid the pitfalls and head towards some nice green valleys or something like that. Then that's really the futurist's role, is to spot the interesting features in the future and to help people navigate through it. But you can never get 100% precision. Now, I always like to say that it's like looking out of a car windscreen, but you're driving in you're driving through fog. And you can pick out various features in the distance, but it isn't until they come really close that you can see a lot of detail on that. But blurred vision is better than none at all.
But you mentioned that you thought, and I think many people think, that there is an accelerating pace of change in the world. And if you extrapolate that pattern of acceleration, don't you reach a point that the transhumanists talk about as the singularity, some point in this century, where those trends go off the map, and we just haven't got any idea what could possibly happen after that?
I buy into that idea. It isn't a single point, of course. I mean, if you look at an exponential curve, at any level of magnification, it's a nice smooth curve. It just gets steeper and steeper and steeper. So there certainly comes a point where you can't extrapolate much further in the future without making wild, errors. That point is probably about 15 years away. It's not that far away. I make predictions all the time for 2015, sort of maybe as far as 2020, but the level of confidence I've got for the ones coming after 2020 is very low indeed, because the rate of change of technology is just so rapid. And for example, if we take things like machine intelligence, we're expecting to get computers roughly the same intelligence as human beings. We mean ordinary human-like intelligence by sometime between 2015 and 2020. After that, they will continue to develop. In fact, they will be designing their own offspring. And we head towards this thing called a continuity where, that you've got smarter and smarter computers every year, leaving us behind. And they're doing the development. They're doing the science and technology and the research. And the rate of change which they're bringing about is kind of like E.T. landing in his spaceship and giving us all these toys that would, you'd otherwise think might be thousands of years in the future. So, there will come a point not very far away from 2020 where the rate of acceleration is just that rapid. And you just can't see past that with any level of certainty.
So you're working as a professional consultant to corporations, and I guess this leads me back to my initial query about the state of futurology. It seems that futurists like yourself who see that there's going to be that kind of discontinuity and that there's this veil across the very near future, I bet corporations don't want to hear that. I mean, corporations are kind of relying on you to tell them how they can make profits after 2020, and you're telling them all bets are off after 2020.
Well, most companies are quite happy that there's a lot of certainty in the very long term. What they want to know is that there's some reasonable certainty in the short term, and that they're going to survive at least until the end of their term in office. If you've got the average board member stays in office 4 or 5 years, just like politicians do, and as long as nothing happens during their shift, which is going to knock everything out of sync, then they're not usually too fazed by that. Most companies accept that they've got to adapt as time goes on. So you'd be surprised as how little it worries companies. I mean, you can tell them that their entire industry won't exist in 20 years' time. It doesn't worry them because, we've seen companies like Nokia going from rubber manufacturer to making mobile phones in less than a decade. And, they're an extremely successful company, but they're doing totally different things than they were a decade earlier. And telecoms, we're speculating that the telecoms industry might not exist in 2020, 2025. You just don't need it anymore. But we're not worried by that. We're expecting to be doing different things ourselves. So, there's a lot of change ahead. Sensible companies will always try to adapt. They'll always do the long-term planning as far as they can. But, the fact that the long-term future is going to look very different than today doesn't really worry them.
I'm speaking with Ian Pearson. He's a leading futurist in Britain and works for British Telecom as a consultant. Now, one of the original futurists, the founders of the field, Alvin Toffler, he argued that societies needed to seriously grapple with futurology in order to become anticipatory democracies, that future scenario planning needed to be woven into the democratic discourse so that we could begin to seriously grapple and take control of our futures.
Yep.
Our political system seems to have become, if anything, more short-term rather than more long-term in its orientation and its planning. I mean, I know that American-style politics has invaded Britain as well. So do you think that there are anticipatory trends, that there are trends in the evolution of our political mechanisms that you can point to that would allow us to become more farsighted and anticipatory?
Yeah, I think what we're going to see here is that there's two different paces of change that politicians are concerned about. There's an awful lot of things which are happening right now that they have to react with. And those are the headline things that we see on the papers every day. There's a war in Iraq or something, or, the recent news with Rumsfeld. These sort of things are instantaneous decisions that politicians have to grapple with all of the time. And it's right that they should be concerned with those. But they are concerned about the very long term as well. And I've seen a lot of reports about, planning for very long term future technology, from the US. We've got similar projects here in Europe. I'm just back from Oslo, where we were discussing, you know, what Europe's going to do about nanotechnology, biotechnology, information technology, and cognition right up to 2020. So governments are sponsoring the kind of research which will allow us to adapt in the 2020 timeframe. And a very heavy element of that is looking at social change and how can we make society able to cope with this, and exactly which way do we want to go given the options that the technologies will open. And that's the kind of research which governments also sponsor. It isn't just the very short-term stuff that we see on the newspapers every day.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that the EU is seriously investigating those. We do also have the NBIC initiative, the Nano-Bio-Infocogno initiative here in the States, and National Science Foundation. But it's interesting that it's being conducted at the EU level, because one of the trends that futurists have long predicted and has been slow in arriving has been a global governance, federal governance of various kinds. In your own speculation, up to the singularity at least, do you see increasing trends towards the development of global governance and transnational governance?
Yes, I think the evidence, again, we see the way that Europe's changing. We're gradually heading towards, you know, bigger and bigger Europe. We've just accepted another 10 countries into the European Union. There are several other countries going to join, or probably going to join in the next few years. And, you know, that will probably expand a little bit. And a lot of Europeans think this is a sort of a prototype for, you know, some sort of very far future style of world government, where you've got, you know, countries with very, very different views, as you have in Europe, and very different languages. You know, there's previously not an awful lot in common, but they're managing to learn to work together in relative harmony and sort out things for mutual benefit. Now, and of course, the U.S., you know, went through this sort of transition a long, long time ago, and you now have a very viable culture over there with, you know, there was lots of different states with little microcultures differently. Maybe you didn't have quite the same language differences that exist in Europe, but, you know, you've gone through the same sort of transition a long time ago. And I think we're seeing other regions of the world going through the same sort of thing. You know, we're seeing, you know, Far Eastern countries starting to work together, you know, in quite good cooperation and so on. I think gradually we're heading in the right direction towards, you know, some form of global government. And of course, we already have global regulation for industry. We've already got global things like the World Health Organization and the United Nations and stuff. So, you know, at some levels, at least, we already have little elements of global governance, even if we don't have, you know, global MPs and so on. So it's we're heading in generally the right direction. But, you know, given the levels of disagreement around the world at the moment and the level of conflicts and so on, it's very, very hard to imagine that we're going to see a true global government in any real sense of the word in the next 50, 60, 70 years. I would think it's at least 100 years away, personally.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, personally, I've always been more optimistic about it because, and I guess this gets at where futurists have, what they have as the fundamental motor of social change or historical change. I've been more of a materialist about this, hoping that our growing economic interdependence and the threats that we face from war and environmental destruction would force us towards that kind of global governance. But there's been a contrary view of a clash of civilizations, a fundamental disagreement between, for instance, Confucian, Islamic, and Western civilization. Do you side with one or the other of those dynamics?
I just think that the differences are very, very large. You know, there obviously is a certain unity in the fact that we all want to live in peace. You know, that's pretty well around the world. I think nobody wants to have wars with each other. But the difference is in exactly what the value systems are, you know, that we should be governing these things on, are enormous. You know, we don't have any universal agreement on human rights around the world. You know, there are regular conflicts about human rights and whether you should be doing this or whether you should be doing that. You know, there are lots of conflicts over territory. There's going to be lots of conflicts in the next few decades over water supply and so on. You know, these things seem inevitable, and it's going to be a long, long time before we can quieten those down. But everybody in the background wants to work, you know, and live in peace. But it's just not human nature to be able to do that very easily when there are so many sources of potential conflict. Now, technology, I think, helps gradually because, you know, technology is bringing about globalization to some degree, and it's forcing people to work with each other, you know, whether they want to or not. And they're gradually getting used to each other, and they're gradually learning that the people across the other side of the fence are not so nasty after all. You know, we're gradually getting used to working with each other and living with each other, but we shouldn't underestimate how long that's going to take. You know, if we look at conflicts around the world, a lot of those conflicts have been going on for centuries, and I think it's just too optimistic to expect them to, you know, to live in peace and harmony and, you know, be lovey-dovey within the next few decades. I just don't think that's going to happen.
part of the issue there is whether there's going to be increasing secularization, which sure. at least us secular people like myself think would be an optimistic scenario, or in, some resurgence of fundamentalism as we've seen in yes. some corners of the world. And there's evidence on both sides for a resurgence of religion and for increasing secularization. What do you think?
I think we'll see both in parallel.
Yeah, you think that they'll go in parallel?
Yeah, I don't think that, I mean, obviously within a single person you're not going to get both of those happening, but within a society it's quite possible to see, a rise of fundamentalism at the same time as you see a rise of secularism. I mean, here in Europe, most of these Western European states are heading towards increasing secularism, but there are also elements of that, with immigrant populations and so on. We're seeing elements of fundamentalism increasing as well. And a lot of people are speculating that we might see religious revival again in the next 5 or 10 years. So, that's a certain possibility. Because people are getting increasingly disenfranchised by modern living, and they really don't like it very much in some degree. So, they're heading back towards a platform in which religious revival can happen more easily, and that's quite likely in the 5 to 10 year time frame. So we might well see a lot of the population becoming increasingly secular, and we'll see the rest of the population becoming increasingly religious, and a lot of that will be fundamental religion. So I think these two are quite likely to happen in parallel. You just get a greater polarization of society rather than everybody heading towards the same goal.
I'm speaking with Ian Pearson. He's one of Britain's leading futurists. I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. Another one of the trends that there's much debate about and contrary evidence and reports on both sides is whether there's increasing inequality in the world, inequality between the developed and developing world, or whether there's globalization in particular is leading to an increasing development of the developing world and an equity in the global scale. Do you take a position on that particular dynamic, and where do you think it could be heading?
Yes, I think that things like inequality—that's one area where technology is going to make a huge difference. I mean, in the developed world today, we've got access to very high technology, and I think for a few years we're going to see the difference in overall wealth and well-being between the developed world and the developing world will increase. But in the longer term view, the gap actually starts to close. And the reason for that is actually quite straightforward when you look at the technology. If you take, for example, a country which hasn't really got much infrastructure, it's quite a poor country, it's just starting to develop, starting to get money, when they go out and invest in something like information technology infrastructure, they don't go out and they put in Stroudger exchanges and then go through the electronic exchanges and then eventually the stuff we've got today with ATM and ADSL and all these things. They go straight for the brand new stuff. And anybody that's bought a computer knows that when you buy a new computer, it's cheaper than the last one, and it's a lot better. So they will go straight in with really high technology, which is very advanced, which hasn't cost them very much money to buy. And they won't have all of this legacy stuff that the rest of us are still trying to make some money out of and trying to milk for another couple of years just to make sure the investment pays off. So, it's very, very rapid rate of catch-up. And the further you go in the future, the cheaper that technology and the better that technology becomes. So the rate of catch-up, it becomes really quite high. You can take a few example technologies which really might make a difference. We've seen the size of PDAs, they're pretty much the same. Sort of Palm Pilot-sized PDAs are quite common there. But the power of those things and the cost of those things is improving all of the time. Now, you could imagine in a few years' time that somebody in the middle of a developing country, for maybe $10 or $15 or $20 could get access to a PDA with a cell phone built into it, maybe wireless LAN built into it. It would have hundreds of megabytes of memory on it. And they would have access via, symbiotic networks, which they don't have to pay for, to the World Wide Web. And they can get access to all of the best educational material from MIT. And they can access that. They can learn. They can learn to write programs. They can learn to do all of the information technology work that any of us can do. And they can start getting rich. And so the information technology, by constantly getting cheaper and better, will bring about a point where people in the third world can catch up incredibly quickly with where we are today. They might still be prepared to work for a lot less money initially, so they will steal a great deal of business from the developing world, and they will suck in a lot of money into those countries. And whereas a few years ago it would have taken a very long time for a country to catch up by building factories and doing all the industrial stuff, which takes a huge amount of time, now it's not overnight, but within a decade or two we could see countries catching up. And if you look at India, you know, it's gone from being a very poor developing country a few years ago. A lot of people in India are now quite well off. They've got a very, very large middle class. And in a few years' time, it's expected that they will be able to catch up with you know, standards of living in Europe and in the States. Well, a few years' time, I'm talking a couple of decades here, but, you know, not centuries. So I'm very optimistic that the technology can make a big difference in this polarization that we have today over haves and have-nots. What is interesting, though, is that you still have haves and have-nots, but it'll be based not on cost or ability to pay or ability to drive it by being educated, but the difference will be that some people will want the technology and what goes with it. Some people will not want it at all. They want a simpler, more traditional form of life, and they will just reject it. And that's where the haves and have-nots will be. It'll be an ideological have and have-not rather than one driven by whether you can afford to buy it.
Well, this actually is the transhumanist raison d'etre that we think that there's been an increasing trend both on the left and the right towards a resurgence of Luddism, towards a resurgence of an anti-technology attitude,
sure.
And that there are very few consistent advocates and defenders of the importance of technological self-empowerment outside of kind of a limited corporate self-advancement. You know, their particular technology is something that everyone should buy. So do you think that this dynamic of a political polarization between defenders of technological opportunity and reason and modernity and the project of progress versus Luddism and reaction, is that one of the dynamics that we'll see in the political divisions in the future?
It is. I wouldn't put it quite that way, though. I would say that as we develop these new technologies, we have to build into that the right for people to say, yes, they want that, or no, they don't want it. I mean, I love to watch television and listen to hi-fi, and I like to play with my computer. My wife does not play with the computer very often, and I don't want to force her to do that. She doesn't bother with email. It just doesn't add anything to her lifestyle. She doesn't see any reason to bother with it, and she hardly ever accesses the internet. She's got a perfect right to do that, and I would defend her right to do that for the rest of my life here on Earth. What the issue in there is that the technology can't or shouldn't be forced on people. We should develop it. We should give people the right to buy it. We should give people the ability to buy it and the ability to use it and the assistance to help them to use it. But we shouldn't force it on people in a way that they can't refuse. And what the Luddites would say is that, you know, they don't want anybody to have access to technology. And I would totally against that point of view. I want this stuff and I want to be able to get it and I don't want anybody to stop me. So I'd be very passionately against the Luddite side of it. But, you know, I don't want to go to a point where we force the technology on people either. Now, what we are going to see over the next 10 years as the technology that which we're developing gradually becomes more and more powerful and has an impact on people's lifestyles, some people in the other side of the camp who don't want access to this technology, they will see it as a threat because the neighbors will be starting to use this and that sort of makes them economically less competitive. So they're sort of kind of being forced into this point where they've got to take it. And they will resist that. And we're expecting to see some sort of an anti-technology backlash around the developed world, you know, maybe around about 2010, 2011, 2012, where a lot of people will resent this deeply. And we will see mass demonstrations, just like we've seen with anti-globalization and so on, and the environmental demonstrations. We will see major demonstrations around the world against the power of these new technologies. You know, when we start getting artificial intelligence, for example, which is able to replace an awful lot of jobs that people like doing, and people don't want to employ them, people to do those jobs anymore, and people will resent that. You know, sure, they can retrain and learn to do another job, but you know, they will say, well, why should I? I've been doing this job for 20 years. I like doing it. Why should I be forced to change my lifestyle because this guy over here wants to use this new technology? They will fight against the technology. We may well see another kind of IT Luddite backlash with you know, people fighting against IT. And then, you know, we'll see some of this with biotech, some of it with nanotech, and eventually with cognitive tech. You know, there is bound to be some very deep resentment as these technologies roll out.
You mentioned cognitive tech, and clearly one of the issues that's on the table already is the potential division between those who have access to human enhancement technologies and those who don't. And I can see, you know, I sympathize, as you say, with those who would want to live in a world where they are not oppressed by people who have moved ahead very much more quickly than they were able to. And so it seems like the struggle for democratizing the access to enhancement technologies as well as these other technologies would be the answer to some of these Luddite concerns, instead of banning them, making them accessible to everyone.
Yeah, you could make them accessible to everyone, but it's a question whether they've got a free access to that or whether they're being compelled to access it. I mean, if in the modern world, you know, if you want to get a job, but you don't want to use information technology, you don't want to have an email account, you don't want to have a telephone because you don't like these things, you've got zero chance of getting a job. So whether you like those things or not, you don't really have a real choice. Now, when it comes to, you know, intelligence enhancement technology or something in the future, if we can give you an IQ of 10,000, you know, rather than 130, 150, whatever it might be, if you can do that,
you
might well take that, and you think, great, and I'll do exactly the same. I'll be second in the queue. I want that stuff too. But a lot of people out there will say, well, I don't want you to have that because that makes you so superior to me. I can't compete anymore. My family can't compete. So unless we do exactly the same thing, we have no choice. So you can call it democratization. You can say, well, everyone's got free access to this. Everyone can afford it. Everyone's got the rights to buy it and stuff. But you're in that situation, we're sort of forcing people to buy it. Now, you could speculate that it's possible to have two different societies running in parallel. And I rather hope this is the case, that you can have a fast stream of, you know, very high quality of life with, you know, ultra-high intelligence people with, you know, bionic bodies or whatever it might be running around in the far future. And, you know, they might be having a ball of a time. And they could, in theory, live quite peacefully in harmony with a parallel society based on, you know, ordinary, everyday, today's technology. And no one wants to throw their television away. They just don't necessarily want the brain enhancement. So you could end up with a world with two different human societies, you know, a superhuman society living alongside a conventional human society. Now, I think that there would be a great deal of people leaving the conventional society and gradually moving over into the augmented society as they realize just how much of an advantage their neighbors have got, and they want this technology as well. And providing it can be rolled out gently and not forcing people, people will gradually make that transition and eventually end up with nobody left in the ordinary camp. And I've speculated myself that we might see a voluntary human extinction by about 2200 if we carry on going down this road, because, you know, simply nobody wants to be in the old race anymore. Everyone wants to be one of the new guys with, you know, living a very nice lifestyle rather than living a fairly, you know, dull, boring lifestyle as we have today, relatively speaking.
That's a very optimistic scenario.
I don't really believe it can be done that peacefully. I think that, you know, if we go down this transhumanist route a long way, I really do believe there will be a great deal of conflict. I don't think people will take this peacefully and watch people beside them augmenting themselves. You know, I've done talks on this stuff for a long, long time now, and I've had a lot of people in the audience say, if you try to connect yourself to a brain and to a machine that's going to give you 10 times your intelligence level, you know, I will kill you. Because, you know, they just don't want anybody to exist that's got that much of an advantage. And, you know, if we look at any of the James Bond scenarios, you get some genius living in a, you know, Caribbean island, you know, with taking over the world type scenario.
That I think is the central problem, at least for our side of the fence. Yeah. Well, Ian, it's been a delight talking to you, and I'm really delighted to know that that the EU and various corporations are hearing these kinds of views, because I think a lot of futurists have a much more limited vision of the way the future is going to evolve than your own. I linked to Ian Pearson's work from the Change Surfer website, so those who want to read more of his voluminous essays can do so. And I really want to thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with.
It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking with Ian Pearson. He's one of the leading British futurists. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.